solution, because United States wants to be the leader of the world, wants to bully everyone else, is not just Iran and West Asia. They're even bullying the Europeans. I mean, you know, the sort of vision that we have, the photos that we have, how he set all these European leaders like in an elementary school and dictated to them what they should do. This is the reality of what's going on. And Iran, and in, under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei, is not going to give in to this sort of bullying, to this sort of dictatorship, and to this sort of policies. And indeed, what we saw from the president is exactly the same tone, the same understanding. As a matter of fact, overwhelming majority of Iranians understand this. I will go even further and say the overwhelming majority of people in the world understand this. But this illusion is being created, and they don't want to give it up. And I think partly is to do with the fact that we are seeing the end of hegemony of the United States, and the power of the United States is diminishing economically. And indeed, it's not going to be long before it diminishes militarily as well. And this is where a dictatorship, a power, becomes very dangerous, because it's trying to enforce his will when he hasn't got the real power. And I think this is all to do with those factors, rather than wanting to have a negotiation, be it on the nuclear energy or anything else. This is not really the issue. The issue is that the United States, under Trump in particular, wants to bully the whole world under his command, and it's not going to happen.
Thank you there, Mr. Shahzadeh, for your initial take. And Batu, I'm going to come back to you. The leader noted U.S. has repeatedly violated its commitments, including the 2015 nuclear deal. It cannot be trusted. He said negotiations under threat and coercion are useless and harmful, and accepting them will only invite further humiliation. Now, I'd like you to speak on that very last remark, further humiliation, Batul. Over 10 years of diplomacy to reach the 2015 JCPOA implementation, Security Council Resolution 2231, and the culmination of the JCPOA, gone overnight in Donald Trump's signature, presidential decree. Recent diplomacy to reach a new deal or understanding, you very well know, postponed for attacks on the country and its nuclear facilities. So tell me, if this isn't being a part of a deceptive plot and being played, what is?
Absolutely. Here the leader is outlining that this has been tried and tested. You don't have to drink all of the ocean to realize it's salty. America, as you've rightly mentioned, was the one who tore the deal in 2018. What is the point of negotiating, reaching an agreement as if it was properly reached? Then what's the point if in one pen everything gets terminated? You know, Trump does not comply. Those in power in America are obsessed with their power and the force that they can use. They are above every law. Guarantees has no meaning. An American president can come and take America out of all the international agreements that Trump doesn't like, including the UN Human Rights Council. At this rate, we're even going to see Trump, withdraw from the UN. So it's absolutely, as you say, that 12-day war in Iran raised doubts about the very legitimacy of negotiations, because it's become clear that America had exploited this diplomatic openness and used it as a deception to strike Iran. This demonstrated that the party confronting Iran, that is America and the Israeli occupation entity, uses all means, including diplomatic traps and deception, to achieve its goals without hesitation, without concern. They are deceptive in their nature. They are a maneuvering party that cannot be trusted, and Iran has a painful experience in this. So today, those who still call for dialogue and those who understand the futility of dialogue after the strikes have realized that following this 12-day war, the situation has completely changed. Iran right now cannot afford to be deceived again in the same way, despite attempts to lure it into that same diplomatic trap. It is clear that they do not want negotiations as a means to reach a solution. They want it to impose their conditions. And as Sayyid Ali Khamenei mentioned, they determine the outcomes of the negotiations based on the results that they want. So they want negotiations as a way to force surrender, not to find a solution according to international laws or the requirements of the IAEA, with which Iran, by the way, has signed an agreement and followed its terms to the T. So these terms have not been respected, and what was agreed upon has been torn apart by the principal signatory, which is America, without regards for the for the signed agreements or the results achieved. If there is no basic level of trust, negotiation in and of itself and diplomacy has no meaning whatsoever.
That's a really good point. And you know, Mr. Shahjadi, that brings me to the fact that the U.S., they want Iran to be at zero uranium enrichment, right? And the funny thing is, to Batul's point, they had an agreement that they violated and they ditched, and it was the only deal that stopped centrifuges in Iran from spinning. They did that back in 2015, and then now they attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. Please tell me how their policy and approach has worked for them. And before you do, let's also reflect on this. Back in 2015, as a result of the JCPOA, where was the percentage at when it comes to Iran's uranium enrichment? And since the U.S. opted out and they basically let the JCPOA go up in flames, where is it at today? And tell me how well U.S. policy has been working against Islamic Republic and its peaceful nuclear program.
It really is very clear. It's ample clear right now, if it wasn't from the day one. And I think to some people, including the leadership in Iran, this was clear even from the outset. And Ayatollah Khamenei indicated very clearly that he was never trusted America. I mean, now, and the fact that the United States cannot be trusted is so obvious, is so many sort of indication that United States have always broken its word, and it's been promising the world and delivering nothing. And it has done so not just in Iran. I mean, look at the implication of U.S. involvement in the whole region and beyond. It's brought nothing except suffering to ordinary people around the world. So this has been a ploy to defeat Iran's will of standing and being independent and standing against the aggressions which has been unleashed by the United States in the region and beyond. And it has not worked. I mean, the reality is that despite all their plotting and planning, despite all their sort of excuses and promises, Iran is stronger now than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And it's, you know, it's got a more capability when it comes to nuclear technology or indeed military technology and economically. In every aspect, Iran, despite all the sanctions, despite all the plotting and planning by the whole Western nations against Iran, Iran has not just survived, but has become stronger and more able and more capable. Iran has now mastered 60% enrichment, and it could very easily, everyone knows, could take that far beyond that. And Ayatollah Khamenei said it very clearly, that we have the knowledge and we have the capability and we have the technology, but we don't want to have a weapon, but we are going to continue our progress in technology and capability. And Iran has shown that it's able to do that. It's doing it. It's you know, every year you look at the progress in Iran. This is a testimony to the policy of Iran, and it also shows that the policy of the United States and the Western nation are bankrupt and are being defeated year in, year out.
Thank you. And Batul, at the beginning of the program, Mr. Shahjad has said that diplomacy, unfortunately, is dead. And when we look at the events in Gaza and in Palestine, we kind of feel the fact that the world hasn't been able to pull together and give Gazans some reprieve, that perhaps it is dead. And then when we look at Masoud Pezeshkian, the Iranian president today, said the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran showed is a betrayal of diplomacy, and then another failed diplomacy example is triggering the snapback mechanism. The Europeans that did nothing towards the preservation of the JCPOA post May 2018 Donald Trump withdrawal are now all of a sudden eager to invoke the snapback mechanism against the Islamic Republic. Yet here is Iran time and again approaching the negotiation table, showing its will to talk, showing its will to be flexible and open. Why is the other side showing Iran nothing but a brick wall?
Right. So you've spoken about a few of the landmarks in the region. I mean, the future direction of West Asia remains very uncertain, but there's one fundamental principle that holds, and that is that power determines survival, and those who lack strength will not endure, including, by the way, the Israeli occupation entity. Any actor that proves that the region does not belong to America will end up asserting itself, prompting a Trumpian response of withdrawal. So we need to understand that it is the force on the ground that imposes itself and the power balance. And actually, the West will be forced to negotiate with those who they realize that the power balance on the ground is in their favor and their strength cannot be overcome. Of course, in the case of the Islamic Republic of Iran, this is the attempt to completely break its leg and to shake its foundation as the principal anti-imperialist actor in the region, but actually globally as a model also to fight Western hegemony. So in light of the unclear picture of where things are headed in this very volatile region, and in light of the comprehensive Israeli impunity and the American green lights, we have to always stress this, that it is Trump and it is America right now that is granting Israel a complete free hand to do whatever it wants in order to achieve its hegemony over the region as a focal point for American presence there. So the absence of Israel or the lack of Israel's strength would threaten all of the American interests in the region, because it means that the resistance has the upper hand and the guardian of American hegemony, that is Israel, would be in a weak and retreating position if it fails to achieve results, which explains the maximum force and brutality that we are witnessing on the ground. So the situation in the region remains very unstable and anxious, moving towards escalation, and this over here, it's very important for Iran to have strength, and that strength is built on its internal components and its inherent strength, as opposed to being some kind of reliance on the outside or the, you know, the removal of sanctions as the position of strength for Iran. It has to be internal.
All right. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Masoud Shajadeh, their chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, also Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst, both of them joining us from London. Stay safe, and thank you both dearly. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity. from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Quranic verses and Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in the previous episodes, we ended up talking about Quranic verses, talking about the destiny of human beings and the destiny of humanity as a collective history. And we said, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, there is a concept of the Day of Judgment. And we talked about different advantages and disadvantages. Advantages of the belief in the Day of Judgment, correct belief in the Day of Judgment, and disadvantages of either denial of the Day of Judgment or incorrect belief in the Day of Judgment. And what does it mean, incorrect belief in the Day of Judgment? Incorrect belief in the Day of Judgment is the Day of Judgment that is only for me. For example, I'm some sort of special creation of Allah, and I'm not going to be judged based on my actions. It's only based on my race or based on my title that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to take me to heaven. No, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, different verses of the Holy Quran, those who, inna Allah yafsalu bainahum, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make distinction among different nations, and they will bring into judgment all people based on their own actions, and part of the action is the things that they voluntarily believed in. So this is also part of the deal. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to favor one nation over other without any reason because of, some claim that they make. No. Now, we said this is incorrect. The incorrect belief is no different than denial, because at the end of the day, both of them, they are dangerous. They bring in bad behavior in people. Now, Quran says, in the discussion that we have over this, we said that one of the advantages of the belief in the Day of Judgment is a strength. But then, there might be some people who misuse this, the belief in the Day of Judgment, in order to establish their own dominance in the world. It's very possible. It's very possible that some people think that the Day of Judgment is for them because I have a certain set of belief. I will have exceptional, procedures on the Day of Judgment. No, Quran says, in fact, remembrance of the Day of Judgment should have this characteristic and this sign. And if it does not have this sign, it shows that it is incorrect belief. What's the correct characteristic of it? It should have the sign of humility. تَلْكَ الدَّارُ الْآخَرَ نَجْعَلُهَا لِلَّذِينَ لَا يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًّا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فَسَادَ وَالْعَاقِبَةُ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. This is the abode of Akhira, the hereafter, the house of the hereafter, meaning that the paradise, the heaven. نَجْعَلُهَا, we have exclusively made it for those, لِلَّذِينَ لَا يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًّا, for those who do not seek dominance and superiority over others. Fil ardh, while on earth, they don't seek dominance over others. Wala fasada, and not corruption. This is very important. Quran says one sign of the people who will have a place, a room in the Day of Judgment in heaven, is that they don't seek dominance on earth. They don't have that bossy nature or personality. La yuriduna uluwwan fil ardh wala fasada. There is a hadith under this verse that interprets the verse, and it's very, in some way shocking, in some way interesting. After the break, we're going to cover the hadith to understand what does it mean, seeking dominance over others on earth.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were reciting this verse of the Holy Quran that would tell us that one sign of the belief in the Day of Judgment is that people who have the belief in the Day of Judgment, they don't seek dominance on earth because they know that the room or the position that they're going to have in the heaven it has one condition, and that condition is not to seek dominance over others. Now, we were supposed to recite a hadith that would interpret the word la yuriduna ala. What does it mean that I do not seek dominance over others? There's a hadith that says a person gets interested in the shoelace that he has. Like, for example, I got a new shoe, a new pair of shoe, and I'm very happy about it that I have this and another person does not have this, and I feel superior to him over some very tiny, small thing that it happens with some people that because I have new clothes, I think that I'm some sort of different from others. Anyways, the hadith says a person gets excited about the shoelace, the new shoelace that he has bought, and he will be an example of a person who seeks superiority. So he sees himself, I see myself as superior to others because of the blessings that I have. No, it doesn't mean you should not have blessings. Now, you can have all the means of welfare or whatever that you want, as long as it is halal, as long as it is have earned through legitimate means. We have to repeat this because there are some misunderstandings over there. It's the attitude. It's the attitude of the person. A person might be very wealthy, but he does not have that sense of being superior to others. You can see that in the behavior. You can see that in the way that he greets people. He behaves with people. And a person might be less wealthy, but at the same time, he thinks of himself as being superior. So it's the attitude. La yuriduna uluwan, those who do not seek superiority, this is in the heart of people, not in the blessings that they have. So the hadith says that even this much superiority, this much arrogance that a person has, makes him one example. You know, the examples of these verses are, according to some of Mufassirun, they are mushakkak, means there are different grades for them. It's not like one black and white. There are different shades of becoming an example of this verse, losing one's humility because of the superiority that he feels about the race, about the nationality. Because I hold this passport, I am superior to that person. Well, for sure, that is one example of seeking superiority or being excited about superiority. So this is correct day of judgment. Belief in the day of judgment, if it is associated with this attitude, then we know that this is correct belief. Otherwise, this is some customized, distorted belief that people have created for themselves in order to justify their own actions. When they tell them, according to some of verses, when they tell them, stop, do not do this, they say, no, نَحْنَ أَبْنَا اللَّهِ وَأَحَبَّهُ. We are the favorite people in the eyes of Allah, and then Allah is not going to judge us. No. بَلْ أَنْتُمْ بَشَرٌ مِمَّنْ خَلَقْ. You are just one community among all the creation of Allah. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to judge people based on their attitude, based on their behavior, and based on their action. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us maintain correct and right attitude and behavior based on certain beliefs in the religion of Islam. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's my voice. You may tame both my hands, but never my soul. No, never my soul. It's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith. No, never
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the US closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the global south. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration. Basically, because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Shiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small and medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually denying the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump. he would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. I must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a short a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
Definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa, to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people to for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive, and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that are have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the debt, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Irechi Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chukwuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janet Ali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it's also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the beautiful capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. And here's what's awaiting you on your radio station. Don't miss a beat. First, we have a new segment of radio productions. We hope these diverse and engaging pieces have provided you with enjoyment and insight throughout our broadcast. As we continue, we return to the profound wisdom of Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul with the spring of truth. Following that, we dive back into another segment of radio productions. Then we open the gate of knowledge. Sheikh Mustafa Mukhtar will explain and illustrate the profound moral, ethical, spiritual, and social teachings found within the Nahjul Balagha, a perfect way to continue the day with profound wisdom. After this, we have Round the World with reporters. Coming up next, another exciting chapter from our radio productions right here on Iran Radio. Don't go anywhere.
For more than seven decades, a single wrenching fact has shaped the politics and the conscience of the Muslim world. The occupation of Palestine and the denial of the Palestinian people's basic rights by the Israeli regime. That occupation is not treated by many across the region as an isolated dispute over territory. It is seen as an ongoing injustice with a moral and religious core, a wound in the body of Islam that demands attention, redress, and above all, solidarity. From Tehran's perspective, that solidarity is not optional. After the 1979 revolution, the Islamic Republic enshrined in its own legal and political DNA a commitment to the oppressed wherever they might be. Iranian leaders framed their foreign policy not simply in terms of strategic interests, but in terms of principle. The principles of the Holy Quran, the obligations of Muslim Brotherhood, and the duty to defend the vulnerable. This is not presented as a rhetorical flourish. It is written into the Constitution, and it has driven Tehran's choices on the world stage ever since. For decades, Iranian leaders have declared it their duty to wrest Palestine from the grip of the occupying Israeli regime. But the question is, why does Iran consider itself as the guardian of the Palestinian cause? Iran's argument is straightforward. If Islam defines community by faith rather than by land, if membership in the Muslim Ummah is a matter of belief, then the duty to defend fellow Muslims extends beyond borders. Citizenship under this view is secondary to conscience. When Muslim communities are dispossessed, when their homes are bulldozed and their children fall victim to bombardment, the Islamic Republic insists that the rest of the Muslim world cannot look the other way. Mr. Hassan Lasjerni, managing director of Khabar Online, which is one of Iran's most influential news agencies, joined us for the discussion.
In foreign policy, when a nation defines its principles, they stem from several sources: history, culture, religious beliefs, and historical experience. With the Islamic Revolution and even before it, Imam Khomeini outlined broad guidelines. Chief among them was defending the oppressed and resisting oppressors. These values are deeply rooted in Islamic teachings, where the emphasis is on resisting injustice and protecting the vulnerable. This is central to why Iran stands with the Palestinian people.
Islam lays out clear rules on matters of war and defense. One important principle, especially relevant in situations of invasion or occupation, is known as defensive jihad. This isn't about initiating conflict. It's about protection, resisting aggression, and stopping an enemy from taking over Muslim lands politically, militarily, culturally, or economically. According to the majority of Muslim scholars, this responsibility isn't limited to the community under direct attack. Instead, it extends to all Muslims who share the duty of defending their brothers and sisters until that defense is sufficient. Until then, the obligation remains on everyone. This is the lens through which Iran explains its steadfast backing of the Palestinian cause. In the words of the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, raising the issue of Palestine for the Islamic Republic is not a tactical matter. It is a fundamental matter born of Islamic belief. It is our duty to free this Islamic country from the domination and grasp of the usurping power and its international backers, and to entrust it to the Palestinian people. This is a religious duty, the duty of all Muslims. All Islamic nations, all Islamic governments are obliged to do this. This is an Islamic duty. We also welcomed Mr. Nasser Abu Sharif, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad's representative in Iran, who shed light on Tehran's role in backing the Palestinian cause.
Iran has supported the Palestinian cause across all fronts. The country consistently advocates for Palestine in international forums. Its foreign policy has always placed Palestine at the center. In addition, Iran promotes the Palestinian narrative in opposition to Zionism.